BBC News with Sue Montgomery. President Trump has welcomed the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer to the White House for talks expected to focus on Ukraine.
We're going to be discussing many things today. We'll be discussing Russia-Ukraine. We'll be discussing trade and lots of other items. And I think we can say that we're going to be getting along on every one of them. We've had a tremendous relationship.
It's their first meeting since Mr. Trump shook the transatlantic alliance by opening bilateral negotiations with President Putin to end Russia's war against Ukraine. Sir Keir will make the case for US security guarantees for Ukraine after any ceasefire. The British Prime Minister is also expected to try to convince President Trump to pause any potential trade tariffs on the UK. The imprisoned founder of the Kurdish militant group, the PKK, has called for his group to lay down its arms and end its four-decade struggle against the Turkish state. Abdullah Öcalan said he was responding to a new environment in Turkey. Emily Wither reports from Istanbul.
In a letter written in his island prison near Istanbul and later read in a statement by Kurdish politicians, Turkey's jailed militant leader Abdullah Öcalan made an historic call to his Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, "Lay down your arms and dissolve." The move could end its 40-year conflict with Turkey that has left tens of thousands of dead on both sides. The PKK has been fighting to secure Kurdish rights since 1984, and it's not clear what concessions the group have been offered by the Turkish state in return.
Tributes have been paid to the American double Oscar-winning actor Gene Hackman, who's died aged 95, alongside his wife, Betsy Arakawa. Their bodies were found at their Santa Fe home, along with one of their dogs. Foul play is not suspected. The celebrated filmmaker Francis Ford Coppola called the actor inspiring and magnificent. Gene Hackman won the Best Actor Oscar for the thriller The French Connection and Best Supporting Actor for the Western Unforgiven. Sandro Manetti from the Hollywood International Filmmaker magazine says his death will be a shock to many.
Here in Los Angeles, the city is getting ready for the Oscars on Sunday. But after this tragic news, all the talk will not be about who will win. It'll be about what we've lost. Gene Hackman was never showy, not one of those over-the-top actors. He was always real, regardless of what the part required. And he was an inspiration to so many.
Explosions during a rally held by a rebel group in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo have killed at least 11 people. The blasts happened just after the M23 leaders had addressed thousands of people in Bukavu. BBC News. The online influencer and self-described misogynist Andrew Tate and his brother Tristan have arrived in the United States after Romanian prosecutors agreed to let them leave. The brothers had been arrested in Romania 3 years ago and faced trial on allegations of rape, trafficking minors and money laundering, all of which they deny. HIV charities in South Africa have called on the government to step in to fill the gap left by the sudden cancellation of US aid. The Trump administration cut its HIV programs overnight. South Africa, where almost 8 million people live with the condition, was the biggest beneficiary. Myeni Jones reports from Johannesburg.
Representatives from organisations that work with HIV patients described the chaos and despair caused by the termination. The head of the Desmond Tutu Health Foundation said she predicted a disaster as a result of the funding cut, adding that it could cause 500,000 unnecessary deaths. A public health expert said some of the services affected include community testing and tracing, as well as specialist clinics that help pregnant mothers from passing the virus to their unborn children. South Africa has been the biggest beneficiary of the US President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, also known as PEPFAR, an initiative set by the former US President George W. Bush in 2003.
Police in Israel say at least 10 people have been injured as a car was driven into a group of pedestrians north of Tel Aviv. A 17-year-old girl is in a critical condition. Police said the attacker had been neutralized. A Spanish court has reduced the sentences of two men convicted in the so-called Wolfpack rape case due to a legal loophole. They were part of a group that gang-raped an 18-year-old woman at the 2016 Pamplona Bull Running Festival. Outrage over their initial convictions for sexual abuse rather than rape led to protests and legal reform. BBC News.
Hi, I'm Randy, a longtime WART listener and an Evergreen donor. This year, I will be donating to WORT through my IRA. To lessen my tax impact, I can make a donation to WART, and this might even lower my Medicare premiums and put me in a lower tax bracket. If you are 70 and a half or older, you can do this too. Why did I decide to include WORT for part of my RMD distributions? Well, it's easy. It's the music. WORT has opened my ears to music I don't hear anywhere else. Donating to WART is my way of saying thanks to this local treasure. To learn more about RMD donations, visit the donation page on WORTFM.org or email Susan at WORTFM.org. Happy 50th, WART.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard.
Good afternoon and welcome to A Public Affair, the noontime community conversation on our community radio station, WORT. I am your substitute host today, Bert Zipperer. Alan Ruff was called away. And joining me on this Pledge Drive show today in the studio is WORT's very own Shelly Pittman. Hi, Shelly.
Hi, Bert. How are you?
It's good to have you.
It's good to have you, too. Welcome to the second day of the WORT Winter Fundraiser. It feels like many days already.
Well, it's good having you in the studio. I hope it's good being had, as my friends say.
Absolutely.
So, listeners, pledge early, donate often by internet or phone at 608-256-2001. You can call in with comments, questions, or money. It's all good. And I am really honored to have today as our guest, Bill Ayers. Bill, welcome to WORT.
Thank you, Bert. It's a pleasure to be here. And I think I'm particularly glad to be here on the Fundraising Drive show because, as you know, I'm a huge believer in the public space, the public square. And as the public is being eclipsed with more and more fierceness and velocity. I think we need places like WORT more than ever. We need rainbow books. We need independent bookstores. We need libraries. But for goodness sake, if there's ever been a time to stand up and speak out and be a community, now is that moment. So thank you for having me, Bert.
That is great. You said it so much better than I would have said it. Bill, thanks for being here. Let me tell you a little bit about Bill Ayers. He's a now retired professor of education and university scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago, an activist scholar. Dr. Ayers has been a decades-long peace and social justice activist who has written extensively about social justice and freedom, democracy and education, the cultural contexts of schooling and teaching as an essentially intellectual, ethical, and political enterprise. Your numerous books, Bill, include Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto, Teaching Toward Freedom, Moral Commitment and Ethical Action in the Classroom, A Kind and Just Parent, The Children of Juvenile Court, Fugitive Days, A Memoir of Your Days Underground in America, and Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. In part today, we'll be drawing from your latest work, released last fall. The book is When Freedom is the Question, Abolition is the Answer, Reflections on Collective Liberation. So again, listeners, please call in with your questions, comments, and money. 608-256-2001. So, Bill, let's start with last November's election results and what's transpired since. You've pointed out that for some, Trump's re-election and what's transpired since January have come as a surprise, even a shock, but that for others, it was predictable. As a way of starting our conversation, I'm wondering if you might share your take, your read on where we currently are.
Well, I think that this is a precarious, a difficult, frightening political moment. Not the first frightening political moment we've lived through, certainly not the first frightening political moment for people all over the world, but it is worth noting that this is a terrible, terrible time in this country. And yet, I happen to be with Barbara Smith, the great black lesbian revolutionary from New York who was part of the Combahee River Collective. I was with her the day after the election, and someone asked us, what are you going to do? And she said, without missing a beat, another day in the struggle. And that's exactly how I feel. What are you going to do? Retire? Go away? I don't think that's an option. I think despair is not an option. I think sadness, grieving, anger, all are reasonable responses. But I think that we have to pick ourselves up, brush ourselves off, and name this political moment for what it is, and then get busy in acts of repair and rethinking, reimagining, and yes, revolution. For me, I just go a step further, Bert, and that is to name this political moment. We all know that the Republican Party was captured by right-wing, racist, xenophobic, populist movement a long time ago. What we are now seeing is a bit different. I think of it as a constitutional fascist party in power. And what that means is that they don't need to rely on the stormtroopers or the brown shirts. They are relying on the law itself to undo the law. And I think that's a very, very dangerous, dire, difficult place. So what are we going to do? Well, my advice to myself is gather your people. Be with your people in small groups, in large groups, get thematic conversations going, but just gathering and loving one another, experiencing joy with one another is a kind of act of resistance in a world filled with cruelty and unnecessary suffering. And so I think for me, we have a rolling potluck in Chicago we call the Movable Feast, and I'm going to the Movable Feast as often as possible, being with my people, and also thinking, strategizing, gearing up for what is to become. And resistance is essential. I mean, the more I talk, the more I have one more thought to say. I'm sorry.
Good. No, keep going.
The other thought I have is, I'm still teaching. I did retire, as you said, from the University of Illinois at Chicago. But one of the shameful things, there are many shameful things happening. As a journalist, you must be appalled at the rulers of our society deciding who and who can't talk to them, interview them, watch them. So the White House sending out a directive that they will only allow their people in the press room is appalling. The Jeff Bezos deciding that the op-ed page of the Washington Post will no longer be open to all, but only open to those who support free enterprise and individualistic freedom. It's appalling. But for me, as a lifelong educator, one of the really appalling things is watching the universities and the schools surrender in advance. I mean, last spring, when major university presidents went to Washington and kind of bowed down in front of the know-nothings, not one of them spoke up and defended academic freedom wholeheartedly and full-throatedly. And that was embarrassing in itself. But then to go back to their campuses, call the cops on the encampments, and then wait till the summer to change all the rules of what's permissible. On the one hand, it's shocking and dismaying. On the other hand, we've been here before also. The universities were totally complicit during McCarthyism. They were totally on their bellies during the times of repression. So we shouldn't be kind of shocked into, but we should be angry and we should be resisting.
Shelly's got a question. Shelly.
Yeah, Bill Ayres, it's so good to talk with you. I feel like we always meet under hectic times, whether that's at the DNC in 2024 or during the winter fundraiser and obviously the ongoing political moment. You talked about a little bit about, as a journalist, it must be difficult to keep track of kind of everything that's happening. And I can certainly sympathize with that. That's tough for me. I also know that you're connected with so many protest groups in Chicago and nationally and leaders and thinkers. So I'm wondering, as we're assessing where we are at this moment, you know, there are communities that have specific concerns, the threat of mass deportation, LGBTQ individuals. Some folks have discussions about leaving the country. I'm curious what kinds of conversations you're having. You mentioned one example, but what is the tone of those conversations? You're a naturally hopeful person, but what are folks focused on action or what conversations? What are you talking about?
Well, you know, I'm glad to think about that. I mean, you say I'm a naturally hopeful person, and I appreciate that, and I am. It's kind of a genetic flaw that I inherited from my mother. But
it's a great flaw.
Yeah, but I'm hopeful, but I always make a distinction. I'm not optimistic, because optimists know what's coming. I have no idea. And because I have no idea, I'm willing to stake my life on the possibility of living in a society that's more joyful, more just, freer, more peaceful than the one we've inherited. So I think that being hopeful is a politics and is a choice. So I jokingly tell my kids, I get up every morning and think maybe today we'll overthrow capitalism. And then that night I'm a little disappointed, but I get up the next morning and say the same thing. I'm partly joking, but I really do think hope is a very important. I have a sign on my wall, a line from Mary Oliver, and the line is, just to be alive on this fresh morning in the broken world. And that's how I feel. Yes, the world is broken. You're alive. You have things to do. Get up. Get started. You may fall. Somebody else will pick it up. That's how I think about it. And, you know, the other thing, Shelly, that you remind me of is, you say we always meet in difficult times. I was reading some James Baldwin yesterday, and one of his important essays begins, "These are terrible times." Yes, we live in the worst of times and we live in the best of times. That's always true. So I think we can all delineate what the worst of times are. What does it mean that these are also good times? Well, among other things, we look back at the George Floyd moment. Just a short time ago, 26 million Americans took to the street for racial justice. Never happened before. That's incredible. Young people are determined to not allow the environmental collapse to continue, and they are in the streets. Let me give you another example that I think is important, and then I'll really get to your question. We were having dinner with a man who owns a Palestinian restaurant here on 55th Street, and he's from Gaza, and he joined us, and we held hands, and we cried a bit. And he said, "I've never been so upset, so sad, so angry." And then he said this, "You know, if you'd told me 4 years ago that a large number of American people, American youth, would understand the reality of Israel-Palestine, I would have said you're nuts. But it's happened. And because it's happened, I have hope." So if he can have hope while his family and his people are being decimated by Israeli settler colonialism and U.S. imperialism, if he can find hope, certainly you can find hope. And I think that's kind of the where I generate my energy from. But what are people talking about? Well, I would say there's a deep sense of determination of the people I'm with, my people, the people who come to the Movable Feast, people from the Chicago Abortion Fund, people from the Undocumented and Unafraid, people from the Let Us Breathe Collective. Not one of them is saying, "I'm in despair." Several of them are furious about one thing and another, and they're making plans. But nobody's saying, "We quit," because they won. I think this is a moment which calls on the better angels of ourselves. We can see, among other things that are revealed suddenly, is that the Democratic Party is not a party of opposition. I said that the Republican Party has become a constitutional fascist party, but the Democratic Party is not even a party. It doesn't have a party line. It doesn't have membership. It's a series of blocks. And in those blocks, the dominant people are not only kind of accommodationist, but for 2 months they said, this guy is a fascist. He's a fascist. And then he won and they said, oh, well, I mean, wait, that's not the right response. And so I do think there are blocks within the Democratic Party that one can unite with at a time like this. But I don't think anyone should see that as the vehicle for hope. If there is a kind of, if there are kind of barriers and borders and, you know, ways we can stop this, it's us. It's not the Democratic Party. In fact, in many ways, the establishment Democratic Party laid the groundwork for what we're living through. And so you can't ignore the fact that, you know, that Gaza was a Biden project as well as a Republican project. You can't ignore the fact that the environmental collapse, while the Biden administration did some good things, no one has gone far enough and deep enough in their critique. And to the extent that DEI is now a boogeyman under attack from the right, should not let us lose sight of the fact that there was a lot about that effort that was superficial and, you know, cosmetic. We need a deep understanding of white supremacy, of imperialism, of war, and we need a deep response to it. So the people I'm talking to are continuing to say, okay, they're banning these books. We're standing up against that. Or we're going to organize freedom schools. If they can't be in this school, we'll have freedom schools and we'll read the books we want to read, because free people read freely and we're going to read. Similarly, people are saying, you know, the Chicago Teachers Union is standing up. They are not giving in to this idea that you have to censor yourself in the classroom. The idea that what they're telling us is you can't teach the truth. Friends like Jesse Hagopian, who's a wonderful writer, wrote a book just released called Teach Truth. Wow, that's what we have to do. And I feel people all around me are gathered together saying that's what we're going to do. You can't stop us.
Bill, that's great. We're listening to, we're in conversation with Bill Ayers, and we'd like to take a break here just for a second.
Sure.
And remind listeners that where are you going to hear a conversation with Bill Ayers for an hour? WORT Community Radio here in Madison, Wisconsin. So take it away, shall we?
Well, it's so lovely to be in conversation with Bill Ayers. He's author of When Freedom is the Question, Abolition is the Answer, and he's a host of the Under the Tree podcast. He's also, as you heard at the top of the show, a big fan of spaces for public discussion and for forums. Bill, I noticed you were on KPFA yesterday and they're in their winter fun drive. So you are a huge supporter of community radio and we thank you for that. The grassroots are so important right now, and I think this is an appropriate call to our listeners to show your support during the winter fundraiser to Alan Ruff's program. We have some folks here, Bert, who have answered the call without even being asked.
Thank you.
So we want to thank Harry Richardson.
Oh, Harry, thank you so much.
From Madison, notable WORT volunteer as well. Harry does it both. He gives his labor and his time, and we know time is the most precious thing there is. Close second for WORT, though, is your financial support. So Harry's favorite shows are A Public Affair on Thursdays and Fridays, Letters and Politics on KPFA, and the WORT Evening News. And he has a comment, happy birthday, Alan. Alan celebrated his birthday earlier this week. We also want to thank Scott from Columbus, Wisconsin, donating over there in Columbus. And Scott says their favorite shows are Blues Cruise, The 8 O'Clock Buzz, Muddacres, and A Public Affair. You can see the kinds of programming that we have in WORT just through these favorite shows. We have long-form talk shows. We have local news programs. We have some fabulous blues and bluegrass and all sorts of music in every genre. And all of it coming together in a beautiful contradiction on WORT is WORT and why you spend your time listening to WORT. So we're calling on you to show your support for A Public Affair, Alan Ruff, and to put your money where your ears are. So that phone number to call is 608-256-2001. We have some fabulous thank you gifts available when you call that number, and our phone answerers out there in the lobby can walk you through what our thank you gifts are. One at the $30 level, Bert, is the I Miss Nixon bumper sticker. And
I kind of creep out by that one.
It's an interesting, it's resetting your frame of reference, isn't it?
Yeah.
So anyway, we have many available, but we know that people don't generally give for the gift. They give to give to WORT. So you can also do so online at WORTFM.org/donate, and you can see our thank you gifts available there as well. And I want to thank the thousands of people that do support WORT and enable conversations like these, free of corporate influence, free of the unsteadiness that besets much of the media landscape right now. So,
and have done so for 50 years to keep WORT here.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, we've returned to Bill Ayers and you, Bert.
And just as Harry mentioned Alan's birthday, Alan just turned 76.
I'm sure he loves that you're saying that on air.
Well, I'm just saying you could give donations in the in variations of 76, $76, $7.60 times the number of decades you've been talking or listening to Alan.
Or you could read any, or you could write, you could leave a comment and we'd read it on the air. So that whatever you want us to say. Also, this is a good call that you can also call 608-256-2001 and ask your question on the air as well. We have folks who route those phone calls to make sure that you don't accidentally end up on air. So that's the number, folks, 608-256-2001.
And Bill, Jesse Hagopian, am I saying his name correctly?
Yes.
Sarah wants to remind me that we had him on this show last Monday.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So any thoughts on
Pledge Drive? He's terrific. Yes. He's coming on my podcast next week. And he's an old friend. But I want to go back to what Charlie was just saying, because, you know, I think it's important. The word public is important.
Yeah.
She said, I'm a big supporter of public. I'm a big supporter of creating the public. And the public is not, it's not created through polls or through, kind of consumer reports. It's created when people come together to name themselves in opposition to the unacceptable, to the unjust, to the unfair. And I think that it's interesting how the word public in many ways has become derogatory. You know, that when Jeff Bezos says he wants his op-ed page to be just people who believe in individualistic freedom, he's not speaking about a public. And so I think that this is a moment, we were naming the moment earlier, for me this is a moment of urgent movement building, and part of the way we build a movement is we become a public. That is, we don't just kind of exist passively as consumers, we actually act up in concert with one another, arm in arm, heart to heart. And in some ways the word public is not only used as a derogatory term from the right, but it's almost become racialized. Public housing, public transportation, the public hospital. These are good things that are somehow made into their opposite through kind of the chattering right-wing, ecosystem. And I think we have to stand up for the public. I would say one other thing. For me, one of the great experiences is watching a public come into view, which wasn't there before. I don't know if you've seen the movie Crip Camp, but if you haven't, it's a must see, right, Charlie? It's like
we've had that on WRT too.
Yeah, it's a documentary about the discovery of creation of disability rights, and it dates back to the early 70s. And people who didn't know each other, who were living in isolation, didn't name themselves as anything. And suddenly they found themselves together as kids in a camp for disabled people. And they began to kind of experiment with things. Several of them found themselves a year later at Berkeley, at University of California at Berkeley, and they began to name themselves as an oppressed group. They became a public. And that public has had huge impact, not only on our politics and our society, but on actual concrete policy. I'll tell you one quick thing that you might like. Bert, that when they were first getting together in Berkeley, they noticed that several of their colleagues, comrades, had trouble getting over the curbs with their wheelchairs. And so they, late at night, you know, mixed some concrete and made little
curb cuts. Well, that's
great. And they did it as an act of civil disobedience. And I'll be damned, everybody found it useful. Women with babies in their strollers, old people with carrying their grocery carts and so on. And now it's become public policy. Of course, you have to have a curb cut. That makes sense. But that was the work of activists coming together, naming themselves in opposition to an oppression that they experienced collectively, and then collectively acting against it. What a great moment.
That's a great story. Shelley? Yeah.
Well, I was writing down curb cuts as Bill was talking, because I also remember learning about that not that long ago as a story of how the changes suggest, you know, a group of people notices that there's a problem and they need an intervention. And so the fight of disability rights really benefits all, right? This is a direct example where curb cuts really benefit anyone and everyone. And to what you were saying, Bill, the idea of public goods allows all of us to function, right? That is the concept of government and and the public square. I want to ask you for, you know, part of the public to me also means dignity and respect, things that we're maybe not seeing so much of right now, for a tolerance for disagreement, a tolerance to hear new ideas, which ties into academic freedom and other freedom to be heard or to say things. I'm wondering, as you look at activist groups and organizing groups, if you have instructive advice for movement leaders who are perhaps welcoming a deluge of people right now, because
I think
on the flip side of that, there is kind of dogmatic thinking sometimes in organizing spaces where you need to agree with everything on the checklist in order to participate, and that turns people off and away and shuts down conversation and respect for disagreement. So what is your approach for, or what is your advice for movement leaders in this time who are maybe seeing a lot of people join the big tent?
Yeah, I think it's really an important point. And I don't have a lot of advice for young people. I get advice from young people. but I do think that there's a rhythm to activism. And it's the same rhythm that we have for being a moral person, being a good resident or a good citizen, a good member of a community. And the rhythm is simple to say and difficult to enact, but let me just say it quickly. You have to open your eyes and pay attention. You can't make moral decisions or good political decisions if you're not opening your eyes. And if you open your eyes once and get stuck on a single truth, it's like a one bright light bulb, then you're becoming dogmatic, as you say. You have to open your eyes again and again every day, because the world is churning and changing, and so are you. So opening our eyes and paying attention. And parenthetically, Jane Fonda said the other day, the word woke means feeling other people, being empathetic to other people. What's wrong with that? Well, what do we want, people to be asleep? No, we want them to be awakened. And so paying attention is the first step. Second, you have to be astonished at all the beauty and ecstasy and wonder all around us, and astonished at the unnecessary suffering we visit upon one another. And you can't get used to it. I want to cry every time I see a homeless kid in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I see them every day. I don't want to get so I say, well, that's just part of the landscape. We have a million people who are homeless. No, that's unacceptable. And we have to be astonished that it's there. Then you have to act. And when I say you have to act, it doesn't mean do everything. It means do something, anything, and then connecting that something to something else. But, you know, you don't have to be the most courageous person out in the front of the street demonstration. There are many things to do to resist, but you have to act once you've paid attention and been astonished. And then the fourth step is you have to rethink. You have to be self-critical. You have to wonder if I got it right. And the reason that's important is because dogma and orthodoxy comes when you leave out step four. And having taken the live virus and survived, I'm kind of allergic to dogma. And I'm kind of severely conscious of it. But that means go back to the beginning. Pay attention, you know, be astonished, act, doubt, repeat. And I think that the one piece of advice that I do have again and again is when you feel self-righteous, you're wrong. You may be right on the issue or the content, but the self-righteousness is destructive and it's not worthy of thinking people. So we have to, yes, we have to build a big tent. You're absolutely right. We have to decide what's principled in this time. I think we need a united front against fascism. So let's just take one example from we could take millions. Let's just take one example. I can unite with anyone who wants the U.S. to stop sending arms to Israel and wants a ceasefire. Now, I have a much bigger agenda than that. I want more than that. But I can unite with anyone who wants to stop the U.S. funding of genocide. And frankly, a majority of Americans do want that. So let's not put ourselves in a isolated silo and pretend that only us with our precious ideas can make sense of the world. You know, but that's nonsense, because actually people who want an end to war, want peace, we can unite with them. And we can't get to the point where we're saying, well, you have to be so pure in order to be part of it. I do think that often on the left, I mean, I think there's a couple of things that we need to be aware of. And one is that we do become used to being isolated. And that means we don't reach out in a broad enough way. We become used to thinking that our ideas are either too precious or too far out for anybody. But I've argued my whole adult life that on the 10 most important issues to me, I'm in the majority in this country. I refuse to think of myself as some isolated minority. And people who know my history probably think that's a little nuts, because I'm kind of portrayed as the ultra, ultra leftist. But the reality is, as an ultra leftist, speaking as an ultra leftist, I think on many, many major issues, I'm in the mainstream and I ought to act that way. And if I can't communicate that to people, shame on me.
That is great. We're listening and in conversation with Bill Ayers today. Shali Pittman is with me in the studio, and you've got some pledges we've just gotten.
Yeah, we have more people to thank.
Thank you so much.
The second day of our WORT.
Pledge early, pledge often.
Okay, so let's start online first. So we want to thank Anonymous from Madison. Anonymous from Madison really resonated with what Mr. Ayers, I can't talk,
Bill.
With what Mr. Ayers was just saying, which is in their comment, I think, in repeating in that call and response is, when you feel self-righteous, you're wrong. Thank you. And
thank
so
you.
Words of wisdom from Bill Ayers. We also want to thank Jeffrey Leverich, and I hope I said your name correctly, from Stoughton. Thank you, Jeffrey. Jeffrey did not pick up a thank you gift, just wants to support WORT show.
That's impressive.
Appreciation
thank
for
you.
Alan Ruff and these conversations. Jeffrey's favorite shows are All Around Jazz, Democracy Now!, and A Public Affair, and wants to share this comment that he's a longtime donor and loves all the programming at the station, and that it's good to have a trusted news source. I agree. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Ooh, that's so loud. Okay. And then we also want to thank David from Madison. David also did not pick up a thank you
wow.
gift. David's favorite shows are this program, the diversity of music and news programming on WORT in total.
And more.
Go for it.
Go
for
it. Oh.
Oh, I thought you were going to hit it. Okay.
I was trying to be polite. Sorry.
And then we want to thank Gary from Madison. And Gary also did not pick
Gary.
Up. We do have thank you gifts. They are pretty cool. thank you. So thank you, Gary. Gary's favorite shows are the news programs on WORT. But Gary also listens to the variety of music here on WORT. So Gary and David and Anonymous and Jeffrey and Scott and Harry so far during our fundraiser. 608-256-2001. That's the number to call to make a donation to WORT or call in with your question. How often do you get to ask a question of Bill Ayres? So you can do that too. 608-256-2001. You can also go online and give at wordfm.org/donate. And we have 20 more minutes in the hour to either ask a question or give to this program.
So donate early, donate often, donate again. And thank you for donating.
Yeah.
We all need to stand together at this time, and our money needs to stand together. And we appreciate that.
And I understand that financial uncertainty right now. It means even so much more. So thank you. If you're not able to give right now, we also completely understand. But WORT is supported by thousands of people banding together to build a kind of collective solidarity to enable conversations like these. And that's really important and so unique.
Mm-hmm. Bill, back to you. You're nodding your head. Look like you have something you wanted to add.
Well, I was going back to what Charlie raised about dignity. You know, I do think that, you know, I think that where we are strong, those of us in the progressive left or in the revolutionary left or in the social movements, where we are strong is that we believe in the dignity of all persons. We have a moral compass that tells us that every human being is of incalculable value, and we'd like to build a world where every human being is fully seen, fully realized, fully participatory, and so on. And so one of the things I think we should mention every time we see one another is that the cruelty of the current administration, the coarseness of our society, the picking on the vulnerable people for no other reason than to kind of get a little ahead of somebody else. So we have to call out that transgendered people are fully human, just like you, just like me. If you go back 30 years, I'd never heard of such a thing. And how, you know, and so I was in the dark. Paying attention has brought me to the trans community. There's beauty there, there's love there, there's awesomeness there. But it's a teeny tiny group of people. And to pick those people out, as the powerful have done, and to hammer on them, it's just unspeakably unfair and gross. So I think that we have to stand up for everybody, and we have to get our moral compass in order. You know, the other thing that I wanted to say about movement building and about, we were talking about creating a public, you know, the Crip Camp example, see that documentary, it's on Netflix, it's called Crip Camp, and it's about the founding of the disability rights movement. But it gives us, it really is a movie about organizing. It's about how you name an obstacle and move against it. And one of the things that's a kind of a centerpiece of the book I just wrote on freedom is that freedom, the paradox of freedom is that you're most free, not when you're sitting on the couch smoking a joint, I'm all for it, but you're most free when you're naming unfreedom and standing up shoulder to shoulder with others to oppose it. That's when you feel free. And in Crip Camp, you see these moments of absolute joy and delight where people are getting kind of hustled into police wagons by the police and kind of pushed aside and their wheelchairs knocked over. And they're ecstatic. Why are they ecstatic? Because they're standing up against unfreedom. They're standing up against an obstacle to their humanity. And I write in the book about many examples of this. I'm thinking about the Panthers in Los Angeles when the police assaulted them. And if you've not seen Stanley Nelson's brilliant film, The Black Panther Party, Vanguard of the Revolution, it's really worth seeing. But he interviews some of the survivors of the shootout with the LA police in the late 60s, early 70s. One of the guys is named Wayne Farr. And Nelson says to him, well, what was it like? And Wayne Farr says, well, we were barricaded in the office. They were shooting in at us. Bam, bam, bam. We were shooting out at them. Bam, bam, bam. I knew I wasn't going to get out of there alive. And I felt for the first time like a free Negro. That's his phrase. I felt like a free Negro. What a paradox. Why would you feel free when you're absolutely under assault? Well, because as a young person, he joined the Panthers to repair what he thought was a great injustice in his life, in his family, in his community. And he was fighting for that. So here he was standing up against it, and it brought him a sense of freedom. What a wonderful, wonderful insight. And I think we can all learn from that, because we will be freer when we stand up against the forces of war and injustice and violence. And when we stand up in that way together, we can not only be effective, but we can have the ghost of freedom visit us.
So I want to go back to something you said earlier about public. For decades, since Reagan and well before Reagan, this whole idea of the public being denigrated, the whole idea of the public being inferior, and that somehow a for-profit corporation making a profit off of anything is somehow superior. That's in a democracy. Yeah, how do they pull this off?
And it's a really good question. And how do we oppose it?
Yeah,
I mean, I think that it's really important to underline what you just said, Bert. You know, that I think that when we talk about families, we're talking about, you know, we have this idea, when we talk about public safety, we kind of say, own a gun. There is no public safety that's good for the public. Only you can defend yourself. You can't count on anything. When we public education is being stripped and turned into a kind of a vast, unequal encampments of private schools and religious schools funded by taxpayers. It's outrageous. Public health becomes stay healthy. I mean, it's really sad. And if you think about it, any issue you can name, whether it's small or large, has an individual component and a social component. The social component has been erased by the powerful in our country. So when we talk about getting around, the need for transportation, I'm furious every day in Chicago because there's a traffic jam. Whether it's morning, noon, or night, there's a traffic jam going in every direction. Why do we not invest in public transportation? Because public transportation is lower class. I need my vehicle, you know, and the reality is that the amount of money we spend on these freeways and repairing the freeways and these private automobiles, and here we are, Bert, at an inflection point. So we could move toward public transportation. We could invest all that material wealth, all that engineering skill, but instead we're going to have self-driving cars. And instead of a bus system, we're going to have Ubers everywhere. And it's mind-blowing how much we're killing ourselves by resisting the idea that there is a public, that we are in this together, and we would all flourish if we recognize that.
There was a study done in Madison at the UW in the late 80s looking at the subsidy for buses versus the subsidy for private cars. And because at that time there was a talk about we needed to cut back on the subsidy for buses. And what they found was that actually the bus subsidy should be increased tenfold if we're going to actually keep the subsidy for equal with cars.
Right. Well, people literally in Chicago say, I don't want to spend my taxpayer money on the trains or the buses because I don't use them. And yet the taxpayer money is spent on your roads, you know, and I don't use them. You know, it becomes the point you're making about subsidies to buses, though. I don't know why I'm in this mode, but let me recommend another great documentary, which is called The Bus Riders Union, not the Bus Drivers Union. It's called The Bus Riders Union. And it's about a group of activists in Los Angeles who organized bus riders. And like Crip Camp, it's an absolute study in how you organize, how you build a public, because they would do things that in mass numbers, they would get on buses, put their hand over the thing and say, this is free bus, over the coin taker and say, this is free bus day. And then they had leaflets in Mandarin and Tagalog and Korean and Spanish and English. And they would pass these out and people went on a big strike and actually won concessions where public money did go. Instead of just a light rail from the San Fernando Valley, it went to buses and trains, which the working class needs in LA to get to work.
We're in conversation with Bill Ayers. It's a delightful conversation, I just have to say, and inspiring. I'm in the studio with Shali Pittman, and Shali, take it away.
Hi, Bert. I worry about Bill giving people in Madison some ideas here. The bus system's working hard. So we are in our winter pledge drive, and Bill is here to give us ideas and hope and perspectives.
And a pledge wrap.
Yeah, and absolutely, and a call to folks listening. So,
well, let me interrupt then, because Bert said I should give a pledge wrap. I began by saying how much I'm not only admire WORT, but I admire the whole concept of public radio, because we need each other now more than ever. We not only need to build a public and build a movement, but we need information. And so, what you can't get from the New York Times, the Washington Post, you know, MSNBC, you can get from Democracy Now, and you can get from A Public Affair. So it's important that that first note I made about being a good citizen, being a good resident, was pay attention, be informed. Free people need to know things in order to do things. So that's number one. But the other thing I wanted to add, Bert, is that Alan was 77, did you say?
Six.
76, he's a kid. So I turned 80 over Christmas.
Congratulations.
I don't believe that.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I always say it, Charlie, exactly hoping someone will say, oh, you look too young to be 80, but I'm absolutely 80.
I do not believe it.
It's true. And so if you want to give in multiples of 80,
there
that's
you go.
Another way to
that's
give.
Perfect.
So my kids, I have three grown kids and several grandkids and wonderful daughters-in-law. They organized a retreat for my birthday, and we all went to a county north of San Francisco. All year I'd been saying, all I want for my 80th birthday is a Harley Davidson, and they knew that I knew they'd give me a vest or something, but I'll be damned, my middle son showed up with a Harley Davidson that he'd rented. So for a long weekend, I drove a Harley Davidson at the age of 80 with my girlfriend Bernadine Dorn on the back, and it was pretty sweet.
That's great.
That's awesome.
We keep hearing about retreats, and I've been fond of saying, I think the left has to stop retreats and start attacking. We just need to go forward. But
yeah,
anyway,
let's call them an attack from now on.
There,
I like that.
There you go. Shelley.
I lead some more questions, Bert, but we have to pause right here and just say you're listening to A Public Affair. We are asking for your support. 608-256-2001 is the number to call to leave a comment on the air, and we only have a few minutes left, or to donate to WORT to help support this program and all of the station, all of this public good that we have. We want to already thank Scott from Columbus, Harry from Madison, David from Madison, Gary from Madison, Jeffrey from Stoughton, David from Madison, Gary. Wait, am I? I might have rewritten some of these. An anonymous from Madison.
And we thank you all. And I'm always honored when people do that.
A whole collective of folks supporting this program. And Alan has cultivated an audience.
Alan's
and
awesome.
Guests and topics and ideas that are so focused on the topic of freedom and liberation and abolition. And it's really important to hear that perspective, because we can get buried in news headlines without taking a step back and assessing our current situation. So that's why I love this show. And I did want to ask our guest, Bill Ayers, notable activist scholar, author of When Freedom is the Question, Abolition is the Answer, host of the Under the Tree podcast, which examines the question of collective freedom. If you could talk for a moment about abolition. You talk about it, Mr. Ayers, as a wonderful stance toward liberation, and something that's far greater than just ending or putting an end to practices. So you talk about world building. Can you give us a sample of that?
Yeah, I think that it's really important that when people think of abolition, first of all, they think of the abolition of slavery appropriately. And we think of Frederick Douglass and we think of Harriet Tubman. And that makes sense. But abolition goes way, way back. And what abolition, you know, abolition does mean doing away with something. But it's much richer and deeper and more capacious meaning is abolition is world building. That is, what kind of world would we need to live in to not have slavery be an option? Well, that's what abolitionists had to think about in 1840 and 1850 and through the Civil War. What world do we want to build where slavery is not an option. Well, we can do the same thing now. When you name an injustice, you can say what we really need is abolition. I tell a story in the book about a four-year-old mother reading him a story of the Native women blocking the pipeline. And at the end of this kid's story, her son says to her, "I want to join the grandmothers and do away with the pipeline." And she said, what would your picket sign say? And he said, "No pipelines." It wasn't, you know, some pipelines or a pipeline in a different place. It was abolition. Why? Because to a four-year-old, it makes perfect sense. If you've named an injustice that is doing all these bad things, then you want to abolish it. So in the book, I talk about the abolition of slavery. Interesting to me, at least, is that I think in the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels mentioned communism two or three times. They mentioned abolition 25 times because abolition is a reasonable demand when you're facing something that is oppressive and exploitative. So we did away with slavery. What about doing away with wage slavery? We want to abolish patriarchy. What world do we want to build where patriarchy isn't an option? And I think that's the meaning of abolition that I think people should work with. In Illinois, it's not simply unlocking the gates of the prisons, although I'm all for that. It really is imagining a world where prisons are not the go-to option when somebody either makes a mistake or does some wrong. You know, I teach in Stateville Prison, and we closed Stateville Prison this year. Thank goodness. It was a medieval, poisonous, toxic place. But the governor of Illinois, a wonderful progressive Democrat in many ways, he put in his budget a $900 million item to build a new prison. And we're like, wait, you could imagine, can't you imagine? We've been talking about mass incarceration for 20 years. Can't you imagine a world where we invest $900 million in parks and schools and arts programs and, you know, mental health clinics and on, not in building a state-of-the-art prison to whom we know, you know, which kids are going to go there in 20 years. No, we don't need another prison. What we need is to end the pipeline into prison, and that means education, it means art, it means joy, it means community.
We're getting down to the last couple minutes here. Shali, you want to do something, then let's go to Bill to wrap it up?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to thank everyone who has given during this hour, and you can continue to give into Letters in Politics.
Absolutely.
And really anytime to WORT. The phone number one more time is 608-256-2001. And you can also pledge online at WORT. You can donate online. You can't pledge. You just donate at WORTFM.org/donate. And there you can also find our many thank you gifts. We know that many folks who give to WORT don't even pick up a thank you gift. They give because WORT is the gift. But
it is.
We do also have some cool stuff available.
Yes,
we have a new shirt special to this drive, and it actually
by Dan Slick, who lives up there on Winnebago Street at Linden Co-Housing.
Okay, well, let's just give out his address. But thank you to Dan for letting us resuscitate this this design. It's, I don't know if you want to describe it, but it's people raising up into music notes, which is very cool. But it's from 45 years ago. 608-256-2001, online at WRTFM.org. I should mention, Bill, or I keep calling you Bill, sorry, Bert, that we are seeking new donors and folks who haven't donated in 2 years or more.
So now is your time.
And so those donations get matched by a challenge grant.
Excellent.
So it's double the impact. Thank you so much for giving to WRT.
Let's go to Bill for our last minute. Take it away, Bill.
Well, let's go back to abolition for 1 minute. Imagine, Bert and Charlie and whoever's listening, that we were sitting around a room in Madison, Wisconsin in 1850, and we are all abolitionists. And we are a tiny minority. We're against the Constitution, the founders, the law, the Bible, our parents, our preacher. But damn it, we're determined to end slavery. Some of us are going to knock doors. Some of us are going to make leaflets, write letters to the editor. Some of us are going to try to influence Congress. Some of us will build an underground railroad. But it's so unthinkable in 1850 that the world could change. But 15 years later, it was done. Slavery was gone. And now that wasn't the end of the struggle for Black freedom, but slavery was gone. If they could gather in a room, if they could fight on every level to bring about the end of slavery, we can gather in a room. We can do multiple things to end the oppressive system we live under. Good luck to all of you. Go WORT.
Bill Ayres, thank you so much. This has been a great hour. Bill, this has been fabulous. I want to thank Cindy out there, our receptionist, Cynthia answering the phones, the Willie Street Co-op for the food you've given us, Sarah, who's coordinating all sorts of great stuff, Jack in there, the engineering, and Sholly, as always, foundation for all good things.
And thank you, Bert, and thank Alan.
And thanks to Alan Ruff, and we will see him back here next week, shall we?
Happy birthday to him and to Mr. Bill Ayres. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Coming up next is Letters in Politics.
Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Une fois que t'as senti le nom, tu t'allonges sur ton dos.
Listen. BBC News with Sue Montgomery. Donald Trump is holding talks at the White House with the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, with the main focus on Ukraine. President Trump said the US was well advanced on a peace deal with Russia without giving details. He told journalists an aim in negotiations with Moscow would be to return as much territory to Ukraine as possible. Sarah Smith is in Washington.
It's a great honor to have Prime Minister Starmer in the Oval Office. It's a very special place, and he's a special man. And
President Trump.